are. Rock to Recovery Radio, episode 4372. That's actually a complete lie. This is Wes Geer. I'm your host, Rock to Recovery Radio on KX93.5 FM. Brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. And I'm very excited for tonight. I can't tell you why yet. But why are we here? Because we're going to talk about recovery. I somehow didn't die out there. There's a few of us that didn't die, and way too many of us that did. So the reason that we do this show each week is to help give each other strength. You know, when we can talk about this stuff, we can take the power out of it. We can give power to each other. We can share information. We can share stories. And so what we do in this radio show each week is we interview rock stars, celebrities, rad humans, exceptional earthlings that have overcome, that's my new one, yeah, exceptional earthlings, that have overcome huge obstacles, deadly obstacles, seemingly insurmountable obstacles, who have, hard to say, who have come back from a seemingly hopeless place of mind and body, but not just to survive, but actually to thrive, right? So many people that think about recovery, you know, they want to get over their addiction or mental health. They're like, oh, maybe I can beat this thing, but man, life is going to suck without my drugs or my sex addiction or whatever. But we learn that life gets even better and better and better as we stay on this path to recovery. So tonight, very stoked to have this guest in-house. His bio's rad. Like, I always, you know, skim over some of the facts so we can, like, set up, you know, and kind of give a nice intro. There's so much we could talk about with this man. He's worked with so many legendary artists that are close and dear to him, touring with them, tour managing, friending, adulting, motorcycling.
Following around.
Selling them houses. All sorts of stuff. But he also battled a deadly addiction and somehow didn't die, overcame it. And I think most of his glory days have probably been since he's been sober. But one of the things that makes him even a bigger standout to me is the fact that he was diagnosed with cancer and beat that too and stayed sober. That's insane. Like, I can't imagine going through that. So welcome to the show, my homie, Scott Patterson.
Thank you,
and
Wes.
His dog, yeah, and his dog, Fred.
That's Fred, the bulldog.
He's cool.
2 years old, 70 pounds. He's not very athletic, but a fun guy to hang out with.
And he's a great kisser.
Oh, wet, warm, all day long.
I haven't had a kiss like that in a long time.
He has no manners. I love that about him.
Don't you wish that humans were like dogs where you just go right up to somebody and you like lick them and just, well, I don't know if I want to lick other humans, but you know what I mean. They're so friendly.
I feel you could get away with a lot if humans were more like dogs.
I'm
it would be less
you.
Boundaries. It would be awesome.
I don't know how that would affect the Me Too movement, but Jiminy Christmas. So cool. So for those people that don't know at home, I got to throw this out there. My homie, Ernie, a.k.a. Ernesto, is not in here. So I got all these buttons and knobs I got to run on my own. And we made it into the show safely. While y'all were having your nice little Sunday, I'm sitting on the couch going, God, I hope I don't screw this up. But we did it all right. Because, you know, that's kind of what Scott does. He's a man that makes things run well.
I like that.
And so I had a little extra pressure, self-imposed pressure, like, oh, Scott's here. I got nobody to run the board. Hope I don't screw this up.
Detailed information, all about pre-production.
Yeah, but we got the plane off the ground. So now let's get into the story. Scott, what we do is we kind of do the what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now thing. And so, you know, we talk about it often in the intros, like people's stories start in different places. Some people have horrible childhoods and never get loaded or have addiction issues or any issues. Some people have incredible childhoods, but, you know, they're crazy and, you know, smoking crack at age 6. You never know. For you, where does the story start? Like how was it when you were growing up? How'd it feel?
Well, you know, it really does start when I was a kid because both of my grandfathers were alcoholics. And they were practicing crazy, abusive, shaming, insulting alcoholics before I was born.
And they doing that to you?
Doing that to my parents.
Mm.
You know, I only met one of my grandfathers literally for 4 minutes in a field in Georgia at my grandma's house as she was chasing him out of that field with a shotgun.
Holy
and they both died of alcoholism. But both of my parents were raised in alcoholic homes. And, you know, to be honest with you, I didn't talk about this much at all in sobriety up until the last 2 years.
And how long do you have sober?
17 years.
That's a huge statement.
Yeah.
Because I talk about it a lot is that people get time, like I got 12, I got 15 years. Doesn't mean anything necessarily other than you learned how to stay sober if you're not dealing with some of that deeper stuff, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I have multiple guys I go to when I need to discuss things that affect me and my behavior or my fears, how I act, how I react, how I get along daily. And one of them I've known for 25 plus years, and one of the first guys I ever worked with and toured with that was sober. That was my introduction to sobriety, was watching him, Dave Kushner, and then John Feldman when they were in the Electric Love Hogs.
Yeah.
Yeah, back in the day.
I remember them.
They were awesome.
Yeah.
And it was the first time ever in my life to be exposed to guys that were sober. I wasn't sober. The rest of the band members weren't sober. But those two were, but me and Dave are still good friends. I consider one of my closest friends, and we were speaking a lot in this last 2 years. And I started talking to him about my growing up and what it was like. And he told me, he goes, you know, I've known you 20 plus years. I've never heard you talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I spent so much time repeating those behaviors and living in those fears and having really those resentments and angers towards my parents.
Yeah.
I never dealt with it. I didn't want to talk about it. I wanted to be cool and hip, and I worked with cool and hip people, and we, you know, they were making music for a living, and we were touring and doing shows, and I didn't want to tell somebody that my parents used to beat me and my brothers, and they were very abusive and very shaming, and they really liked to punish us in public where people could see it.
Hmm.
You know, and I would watch, you know, my mom would be slapping me or hitting me with this little hammer she used to have, and watching people's reaction, and no one ever stopped them. And it's always been tough for me to get in front of people, but I'm sure, you know, I heard a guy speak recently who has 25 plus years, and he was speaking at this meeting in West Hollywood, big meeting, and he works in recovery. And one of the comments he made is he hasn't met an alcoholic yet that didn't have some kind of abuse, neglect, abandonment, in childhood, something,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I firmly believe that. But so, yeah, that really was where my story began. I didn't address those things to the last 2 years, but my parents grew up in alcoholic families.
Where was this?
At the time, my dad was living in Texas. My mom was living in Georgia. My dad's.
Where were you?
Well, I wasn't born yet. They,
yeah. Gotcha. Okay, I see what you did there.
Listen, is this a four-hour show? Because I'm going back to way beginning.
Yeah.
4 hours of me, people.
It's a marathon, actually.
Yeah.
I didn't tell you that.
No, so that my parents were being raised in alcoholic homes by their grandfathers.
Gotcha.
My grandfathers, their parents. And my grandfathers were doing to them what I suppose my parents did to us years later.
Right.
You know, my dad told, I learned about my dad's upbringing. He lived in a house with a dirt floor.
Wow.
My dad was, and him, my uncles, his brothers, I had three brothers and one, he had three brothers, I had three uncles and one aunt. And, you know, their father would go out and work hard all week at a paycheck and then disappear. And they would leave no money for food or anything for the kids.
He was drinking.
Drinking. He'd go on a bender, and he'd be gone all weekend and come home whatever money he had left and give it to, you know, their mom, my grandmother. And the rest of the week, he was beating and abusing and insulting and shaming the kids, you know. And my dad got out there when he was 17 and joined the Navy, moved to Georgia, and was doing some flights thing down there. And that's where I met my mom, who was living a similar lifestyle across the country with the same kind of father.
Yeah.
Which we see that in life now where, you know,
laws of attraction.
Exactly. Water seeks its own level.
Yeah.
You know, any of us, you drop us in a desert, we can find the connection, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
totally.
Yeah, that's how it all began. And again, the same thing was happening in my mom's house.
Yeah.
And, you know, so.
I appreciate you sharing so vulnerably, you know? And, you know, back in those days, obviously, I didn't live then. You didn't live then. But we didn't have open dialogues about like addiction and using. And Dad, that made me feel small when you said that to me. You know what I mean? Like the lexicon is much different now. It was just a different world. And you know, when people come into this world, they don't get a textbook on here's how to love somebody, here's how to treat a kid. They learn from their experiences, right? So your parents doing what they knew, and that's all they knew. That's insane. Have you ever done ACA?
I don't really know what that is.
Adult Children of Alcoholics.
Yeah, no.
I have some buddies who have long term sobriety who said until they did that, it was like it took them to a whole nother orbit of recovery.
You know, I'm open to explore anything that's going to make me a better man and a better human and be more comfortable than my skin, that I can feel okay.
Mm-hmm.
My parents weren't alcoholics, though. They weren't drinkers. They weren't users. My dad was a rageaholic. And they were violent people, but they were not alcoholics. Mm. You wouldn't, from what we know of alcoholism, if you saw inside our home, you'd be like, oh, it's okay. I remember one of the first times that my parents started falling, their marriage started falling apart, and I was like 14. One of the first times we fled our house in the middle of the night, they took us to my mom's friend's house. Me and my three brothers, it was four boys, and they took us to our mom's friend's house, and we put us on the living room floor. And I heard the women and men in the kitchen speaking about my family and how lucky my parents are and how great everybody was. And I remember that moment. I was probably 14. And the thing that struck me was they didn't know what was going on.
So even at 14, you were aware enough to go, this is all a mask we're putting on.
Like, they don't know what's going on and no one's coming to stop it.
And so how were you feeling when you're 14 and you're going to school and you're having to interact with other people and carry that energy? How was it affecting your personality just in living life?
You know, I'm going to take one step back. When I went to my first meeting, John Feldman took me to my first meeting. Uh-huh. We got home, and he took me to Rodeo in Beverly Hills. Uh-huh. Big, splashy, hundreds mm-hmm. of people meeting. And we sat in the back, and I was out of my mind afraid. I was like, holy shit, these people are so high energy and polite. I mean, one of the most uncomfortable moments in my life. And they started speaking from the podium, being honest. And I was like, holy shit, he just said that out loud.
Yeah.
That was my first experience of adults being honest and people sharing their feelings.
Wow.
And I remember that. And years later, John is my sponsor now, uh-huh. you know, which is awesome because I've known the guy 25 years and he took me to my first meeting. But years later, I'm like, dude, maybe you could have picked a smaller meeting.
Yeah. A little more intimate. Yeah.
So to answer your question, how did I get along when all that stuff was happening at home?
Well, because the feelings, right, is really what give us issues, right?
Yeah,
we don't
exactly.
want to feel. Exactly. It turns into character defects. We act out. We get violent or angry.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. My parents, being from the South, they ate like they were from the South. Everything was fried, Lucky mm-hmm. Charms, Captain Crunch, everything was sugary, you know, pancakes and French toast. And we weren't chubby kids, we were athletic kids, but we ate poorly. Well, one of the things that my parents let us do is we'd get Lucky Charms with white sugar. We had bowls of white sugar, and I learned by putting that sugar on there and eating that, I could change how I felt.
Wow.
And I would.
At how old? And you were cognizant of that.
10, 11.
Wow.
We had a house back then.
Getting a little sugar high.
Oh, it was awesome. That was my first addiction.
it was awesome.
I had sugar on the way down here. I knew exactly what I was doing.
Wow.
We had this L-shaped counter in the middle of the living room, and I used to hide behind it. My mom had to go buy groceries a lot because there was four boys, and they would buy Ding Dongs and Zingers and Twinkies, and I would hide behind the counter and eat that shit mm-hmm. one after the next just to get
kind of binging.
Really? Oh yeah, I was doing it. I couldn't describe it intellectually as I'm doing now, but I knew what I was doing. She's coming home. There's going to be a couple box of Ding Dongs. I'm going to hide behind.
I like the way you say ding dongs.
Ding dongs, you know. So, yeah.
So you're seeking escape even then.
Yeah,
huh?
It was, you know,
some form of fashion.
You know, it's funny when you get time and sobriety, and I do agree with you. Time is important because you learn how to get through life's challenges sober and how to deal with it. And once you've gone through one challenging thing, you're like, I can do another challenging thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I am a firm believer. It's one day at a time.
Yeah, sometimes one moment.
Exactly. I didn't have to. I chose to because how it makes me feel and how I react. I meditated for it when I got up this morning. Mm-hmm. I wrote a gratitude list. I hit my knees. And I really hadn't started done that till the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I do that every day. And I spoke to a newcomer after a men's stag on Saturday. And he was like, oh, my God, 17 years. And, you know, and he's – I can understand. It's like a human. It's like, wow, 17, that could be a person, you know.
Yeah.
But it really does come down to that for me. I need to check myself every day and get right.
They say if you don't have a morning program, you don't have a program.
Write that down.
It's super important to me.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So but let's go back to this. What if you had all this stuff going on, but I want to say, how did you feel? Were you blocking it and you didn't notice, or did you feel some like, I'm hurt or I'm angry because of your home life and what it was like? I mean, you said your mom would hit you on the head with a hammer. And watch passersby's reactions to
people around us, friends. It was.
Did you have shame, guilt, anger? Did you get in fights when you were young? Were you stoked when you went to school? How? What did it feel like?
One time when I was at school, after my parents had gotten a divorce and they moved out of town, and I was living with these. I was 16, mm-hmm. and I was living with these people that were 21.
So you bailed on your parents?
Well, they got divorced and moved to two separate towns. And I made it so difficult for my mom, who drugged me down to Imperial Beach, because that's where she moved me and two of my brothers, my younger brothers, to Imperial Beach. See, she had a cousin in San Diego. I made it so difficult. She agreed to let me go back to this city, Bishop, right below Mammoth, and finish high school.
Yeah.
And I did that, and I was living with my friend from school, his sister, who was already married and had two kids, and they were 21. And they were teaching me how to drink and use. And
when did you pick up?
About 14.
14.
Started at 14. We were still living at home. My parents, there was a long drug out. We wanted divorce, and then years of fighting before they actually divorced.
Yeah.
One day at school during that time, the football coach asked me to come with him, pulled me aside during lunch. And we walked out to the football field. And as a senior in high school, was living with these 21-year-old kids. My parents were paying for everything. You know, that was another thing. My dad was a successful guy. Mm. We had a lot of stuff. We had a big house. Mm. My dad had a lot of things. You know, we owned a lot of places. My dad owned an airplane. He was a pilot. We had boats and motorhomes and stuff.
And good stuff.
Yeah, great stuff. You know, one of the greatest things we had. Outside stuff. And the only reason that I mention that because I've worked in music entertainment for the last 20 years. I live in Beverly Hills. Now I know a lot of friends that have a lot of outside stuff. And it's the same everywhere. None of that fixes or cures us. And none of that makes us happy and makes us content or makes us safe.
Right.
You know? So this football coach pulled me aside and said, hey, listen, I want you to stop hanging out with my nephew. And his nephew was a year younger than I was. His dad, the nephew's dad, was the driving ed's civics teacher, and his uncle, this guy's brother, was the football coach. And he said, you're a bad influence. And I was 16 years old.
So people had...
Yeah, so that kind of... it was like,
What were you doing, though? Drinking, using, fighting?
No,
stealing?
I wasn't... you know what? I wasn't a fighter. I wasn't... You know, I played sports. I was really a good football player. I was a really a good wrestler. Uh-huh. That was my thing.
Okay.
You know, those two things I good. I grew up with three brothers. We had a big backyard. We're always playing those things. So I was pretty good at those two things. I was a womanizer from the get-go.
Oh, hence the song we're going to get in here.
Yeah, so Why
do you think you were a womanizer?
My parents have never told me they love me.
There you go.
And there you go.
SLA kind of stuff, like seeking outside validation to fill that.
Back then, I don't think it was. I know later in life it was validation. I would never go anyplace unless I brought an attractive girl. Because I wanted to look better and feel better and look at me and feel like I'm okay because she's with me. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've done that 1,000 times. But back then, I just think I wanted a woman to love me, you know. Because
I can relate.
Yeah.
Plus, when you're getting loaded, get really lonely.
I can't say if I was lonely yet in high school because it was a small town. My dad was a well-to-do guy. We had a lot of stuff to do. I was very busy getting drunk, getting high, chasing girls. I had a great car. Because I think when you tell your story, you tell it as an adult. When you look back, and I tell it from my adulthood.
Yeah.
But listen, I'm 16 living with 21-year-olds.
That's insane.
I have a
no
great
parents.
Car. No,
yeah.
I have zero supervision.
You're kind of a baller.
Yeah.
Yeah, living, you're a baller.
Yeah. I think for 2 years in a row, I dated the homecoming queen, the class princess, and the cheerleader or whatever. It wasn't bad back then.
Well, it sounds like. Well, you know what? That's a perfect time to bring in our first song that you selected. Which, okay, now here we got to go back to these buttons and knobs. I'm gonna try to do it right here. Can you guys at home guess what the song is? It's by Led Zeppelin. It has to do with Scott's lifestyle back then of seeking. On some level. Seeking love from outside.
That's really what it was. Yeah. When I was a kid, man. I mean, we lived in a very messy family. There wasn't love. There wasn't support. There wasn't kindness. And I know that this happens across the board. This is very common. And, you know, I've been around AA for 20 years. I've been sober 17. I slipped. You know, I had some, whatever it was, 7 years or something, and slipped. One night I went out to work on the Jamaica in this big concert thing, and I slipped for one day. I've learned a lot.
I've
learned how it works, what not to do, what to do, how to stay sober. I can't answer you why I haven't died during that time period of using.
Who can, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I can tell you why I stay sober. So, yeah, this is it's twofold. I did choose it for that reason, but I also chose it because that song was consistently in the Camp Freddy set, and the people that sang it, this was always a highlight of every single show.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah, I'd love to hear it. So here we are on Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer. We're interviewing Scott Patterson. What is a good title for you? Homie to the Stars. Rockstar homie. And this
tour
is,
manager back in the day, like, it's just yeah. The tour manager for and then bing, 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 different bands. I don't know.
Tour manager to a lot of your favorite people. So we'll be right back after this. This is Led Zeppelin, Whole Lot of Love.
You need cooling, baby. I'm not fooling. I'm gonna send you back to school, way down inside. Honey, you need it. I'm gonna give you my love. Yeah.
how do you not just love Led Zeppelin all the time, anytime? Is there ever a time that isn't good for Led Zeppelin? This is Rock to Recovery Radio. We're back. I'm your host, Wes Geer, on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM, human-crafted radio. Also brought to you by our friends and partners, New Vista Behavioral Health. Great recovery programs, mental health, addiction, professional stuff. If you're looking for a program, definitely check them out. And we're here in studio with my homie, Scott Patterson. Incredible story. We're talking about what it was like to be with his abusive parents, and what it's like growing up, living with 21-year-old girls at 16 with a pimp ride, and and trying to fill that hole with chicks. I was doing that. We were talking on the break. I was doing that my whole life. And the funny thing about recovery is, like, I can be in recovery. I have 10 and a half years. You're doing all this good stuff. You're helping all these people. But you can have these other little compartments where nobody – it's not like you're even hiding. But nobody knows how many girls I date. And nobody's going to go, hey, you got a problem. Because it kind of – it's hidden. You know what I mean? Yeah, kind of like what – kind of like what you're saying in your story.
Yeah. I mean, this – you know, my headphones are on.
Well, yeah. Where's your little microphone?
There we go.
Yeah, we got you.
There we go. Better.
That isn't me. That wasn't user. Oh. User. Yeah.
It's always the operator.
I think I got you. Yeah.
You know, here in sobriety now, it's. I don't have any secrets. I try my best to live that. I will openly disclose whatever ridiculously poor behavior I've done for the 100th time. I'll admit it to my sponsor. I'll admit it to my friends. I don't want to have any. Secrets. I don't want to have any lies. I don't want to live my life that way any longer. There you go.
There you go.
There you go. Bring me
okay,
up.
I'll own that one. I'll own that
oh,
one.
Great. That was the gym of all gyms. Damn it. Did you record that?
Yeah. We got it on tape, man. Spin that back.
So, yeah. So, I agree with you. It's, you know, it would be great if sobriety was about drinking and using and we stopped and everything got okay.
Right.
All our behavior changed, all our fears went away. But as we know, you know, drinking, I'm sorry, alcoholism isn't about drugs and alcohol. That's our crutch. That's our medicine. That's what's keeping
it's our
us.
Our medicine.
Yeah. You take that away, you discover that, wow, I have alcoholism, a disease that centers in my mind. I have a spiritual malady and I have to treat it daily to maintain just the level of let me get along and be civil and be a better man. A better human. And it took a long time to actually put all that into practice, but like I said earlier, doing that daily thing is it's my Bible, man. And it's easy now because the results have been great. And it's not like the cash and prizes are stacking to the ceiling. That's not what's happening. What's happening is I feel better. I treat people better. I'm less angry. I'm telling people now about my childhood. And I mentioned my dad was a real angeraholic, yeller, screamer. And when I forgot my first jobs, that's how I was, because that was my point of reference. I didn't know until working for years later. You didn't have to be a jackass and yell and scream at everybody.
That was what you were taught.
Exactly. By watching them.
Yeah, 100%.
So, yeah.
Tell me. I want to get into this, like, the drinking and using part, right? So you make it out of high school. You're kind of a sports stud. And you had your good high school life. Where does it go from there? You were telling the story about how your uncle or something told you don't hang out with the nephew. He's a bad influence.
That was the football coach telling me not to hang out with his nephew. And that's what was going on at school.
So that's high school years. Where does it go from there? Yeah. Like, what's the next level? You start working with the Love Hogs?
No, well, I actually, you know, I moved to San Diego because that's where my mom went, my brothers went and stuff. And I mean, here's the insanity of what was happening in my life at that point. Looking back on it now, there was no parental supervision. There was no guidance. You know, I was supposed to go to college, but my parents had left town. These 21-year-olds aren't supervising. My dad's just giving me money. I'm driving around. I'm dating all these girls. I'm starting to drink. I'm not using yet because we live in a small town. There was no drugs. It was just beer. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And of course,
what town was that?
Bishop, California.
Bishop,
not
I mean,
a metropolis.
No,
beautiful.
Isn't that the place with the thermometer?
Schott's Dutch Bakery. Everybody knows Schott's.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because you stop when you're hungover on the way out of Vegas.
We had a Foster Freeze. It was
there was like three stores than the whole thing.
Yeah, when I lived there, there was two stoplights, one Jack in the Box. Everything was mom and pop. But in the same breath, though, because it's a small town, if I needed gas, I went and got gas in the car and signed my name. If I needed to buy groceries, I go. So it
you
was
just
that.
Had, yeah, you had the carte blanche life for a young guy.
Yeah, you didn't know that until.
So, but where did it go?
Yeah, I moved to San Diego, and one thing I gotten into, I wanted two things when I was a kid.
Girls
wanted,
and cocaine.
It came later, but I wanted that more.
Yeah.
A guitar or a weight bench. We had this cousin come visit us from Texas one summer. He brought all these albums, or the big round black things, and a big piece of square.
I love those.
Albums.
Yeah, vinyl, wax.
Vinyl, yeah.
LPs.
And it was Elton John and Jackson Browne and Three Dog Night and Creedence Clearwater Revival, bands I'd never heard of, things I've never listened to that were kind of, you know, years beyond where I was at. And we started listening to this music and I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. Those are the days I stood in front of the mirror and sang along and Yellow Brick Road and all that. So I wanted two things, a guitar or a weight bench.
Did you want to be a rock star?
That's what I always wanted to do.
Oh.
Ask anybody I work with and they're like, yeah,
I can see that.
We've had to tell them many times, dude, you're not in the band.
Yeah.
Wait behind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
so
funny. That's
but
funny, dude.
You can imagine what we got. We got the weight bench. I had three brothers. So that was, I got the book Pumping Iron.
You got really into weightlifting,
really
right?
Really into weightlifting, yeah. So when I left high school, which they let me graduate because they had had enough of me, and I moved on. And I moved down to San Diego, so that's where my mom was at, and I lived
That's where you got the weight bench and the guitar.
No, I never got the guitar yet.
Oh.
It was San Diego. Started kind of going to this junior college and working out. I got a job at this sports medicine center at the Alvarado Hospital at the time was, you know, way back then was like a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like $200 a month. That was unheard of. It was all these doctors plus all these pro athletes because they had a physical therapy section trained there. It was so long ago. The Clippers were still in San Diego.
Oh.
Yeah. And then they had all these world-class Olympic athletes who would get physical therapy there. And I became a trainer there because I was actually doing the bodybuilding thing. I've got some fantastic
photos.
You got huge.
I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
You're Shreddy McShredderson. But wait, now, did you juice?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We lived in San Diego. You could drive to Mexico and we'd go to Tijuana and you go to any drugstore. And as soon as they see you walk in, the gringos, they had the steroids lined up. What do you want? Testosterone, decadrable, and all. We would just buy it and sneak it across the border.
Were a lot of people in the gym, athletes and such doing that?
Yeah, it was really
you
common.
You weren't the only one.
Yeah, no. Me and all my friends were doing it. It was just like getting high. No, there was no doctor supervision. We were doing it to ourselves. Our only point of reference was reading about it in Flex magazine. And that became my thing. And then in the same breath, I met a guy, too, that was really into weightlifting who happened to be a drug dealer.
Hmm.
And I'm kind of loosely...
Dealing other drugs.
Then. Cocaine.
Hmm.
He was a cocaine dealer and stuff. Had a great Porsche. He was in great shape.
How old are you at this time?
23.
So you're just massive, and now you discover cocaine.
Well, I don't start using it. He introduced me to, he's a dealer, mm-hmm. The great car, the great hair, the hot chick, lots of dough. I'm working at the splashy sports medicine center. And I actually meet a guy who I'm still friends with today. We talked about earlier, Bill Silva, because he's the big time concert promoter in San Diego.
But I know the name.
Yeah. So I get a job with him as more of a, he's promoting all kinds of concerts. Whoever goes through, the Rolling Stones, Ozzy.
Were you a bouncer, bodyguard guy?
I did that for a while as well. Terrible at it. Terrible.
How are you terrible at it?
Well, it just wasn't my thing. Like, right. You know, there was some times at the San Diego Sports Arena where it was fun because it was kind of a thing. The kids would rush the stage and it was our job to stop them.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like
football, back to
like,
football.
Yeah, smear the queer kind of thing.
Yeah.
We being the queers.
Yeah.
But so that's where really it kind of that's where it began. I did the bodybuilding thing. I'm doing the steroids thing. I'm working out all the time. I started competing in contests.
Did steroids feel like a high? You said
not after I started getting high.
Okay.
During that time, it's a whole different high because mm-hmm. It's elevating your testosterone. You're making more aggressive, more strong. The weights are never heavy enough. You're pushing and going.
Wow.
It's more of an anger high.
Right.
You know, brother.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, brother. Okay, brother. More meat, more weights. Go. You know, that kind of shit.
Wow.
cocaine was a much better time, actually.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I got introduced to it. And I can like I said, I did a couple of contests. I won all these contests that I was in. And, you know, that kind of goes back to school. There was a thing that happened. I was dating this girl who happened to be the homecoming queen, graduated a year after me. And she had moved to San Diego and we're dating and I'm doing the bodybuilding thing and I'm doing the kind of exploring the cocaine thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not really in yet because I'm an athlete, you know.
Of course,
I'm just kind of just, I'll taste.
You care about your body.
Touch. Yes.
Right. My body.
Okay, I'll
temple.
Do it for a better workout.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you do coke and go to the gym?
Yes.
That
I
sounds
recommend
horrible.
That was terrible.
So
this
you're doing
girl,
pretty good at this point.
Yeah, I'm
like.
All right. You know, But I'm, this girl, I'm supposed to get married at 19. I met for Bishop the hometown.
She's 19.
I'm 19.
You're 19.
Going back a little bit. Sorry okay. about that. It just okay. came to me, this thing. And I wanted to compete in this contest before I turned 20, this Mr. Muscle Beach thing. And she, anyway, that didn't happen. It's one of those things in life in the moment seem like I'm making a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. Her father had bought one of my father's business. Her family was very wealthy. They were moving back to Bishop. I was going to come work at one of my dad's old businesses, this lumberyard, and have this life of kids and, you know, living on a farm. And I was like, nope. But, you know, it's the point of it is as obviously we go through our lives and there's those moments that things go wrong or something doesn't happen and you have that regret only to realize that by not doing something or something not going your way turns out to be the best thing.
Sure.
Yeah. She went home and married a guy within 6 months whose name was Scott Piercy, who was in the same grade as me.
Whoa.
Yeah.
She just has a thing for Scott Piercy.
Yeah, exactly.
So when did it get bad?
It took a long time to get bad and before I experienced
sobriety. Just when you started like tour managing
when I got on the road, it got bad, but I drank and used for many, many a tours. And it was one of those things like, you know, as long as you maintained, as long as the job got done, you left on time, you weren't late for shows, everybody was getting a hotel, we didn't miss a plane flight. There was never like, oh, this is way out of control, you know, because not everybody's indulging, but it, you know, we're a rock band, you know,
sure. So it's a lifestyle.
Yeah, it's a lifestyle. It's, you know, one of the first big tours I did was the first Family Values with Korn.
Mm-hmm.
And even though most of those guys weren't used, and I have found this over the many of artists and tours I worked on, most of those guys aren't drug addicts, alcoholics. The ones that really are, you read about in the press. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that I really enjoy doing, the tour managing things, working with musicians, that they're really super professional, really talented, really disciplined, you know, and they've created something out of nothing.
Yep.
We want to write a song and make a record and touch people. And it's like, holy shit, dude, we're playing stadiums and people are singing along to something you created. I love that.
Yeah.
I love being in that energy and being on the stage, so... There was, of course, a number of us on that tour because it was Orgy opening up for Ice Cube, Rammstein, Limp Bizkit, then Korn.
Amazing lineup,
amazing. Yeah. It was awesome. Stadiums.
Yeah.
And sold out. Korn was on fire. Limp Bizkit was on fire. But Orgy went on first. They were on.
We had Ryan on the show.
He's awesome.
Love
I
Ryan.
Love Ryan. Did he tell anything about that tour?
All he talked about was you and the incredible job you did, tour man.
I still give him money for that. Well, that was Ryan's first tour. Sold out stadium. Hit single. It was fun. Yeah. Awesome fun.
So we talk about it was fun, and then it was fun with problems, and then it was just problems. What were some of the first problems you encountered? Where it was like, not just kind of like, oh, I messed up, we were partying too hard, but like where you started looking at...
You know, the first time I really had a moment where I'm like, dude, you're out of control, was Ugly Kid Joe touring with Def Leppard. Mm-hmm. We were opening up for them in the States. They were massive, you know.
Huge.
They had all, yeah. And we were opening for them. Every show was sold out.
You're TMing
out. Yeah,
UKJ.
I'm TMing Ugly Kid Joe. And it kind of goes back to working for Orgy. They went on, the doors opened at 7:30. They went on at 8 and played 30 minutes. We didn't leave until 1 or 2 in the morning.
Sure.
So between 8 and 2 a.m. backstage.
Yeah, I know.
Lots of great shenanigans and fun.
Yeah. Well, we talk about it, too. When we talk about the disease, there's probably a lot of people out there that has the potential to become an alcoholic or a severe drug addict, but without the opportunity to cultivate it. Like, I feel like even in my own life, I was kind of like a weekend warrior just drinking. But then when the drugs came and the record deal came, and then I had the opportunity being an opening band for 8 years and having endless supply of everything, right? From 7 before you play till 2 in the morning. It gives the opportunity for the drugs, the alcoholism to progress.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's what happened for me.
And that's what happened, yeah.
So you're going to say... What
you know,
was,
we actually toured together. You know that, right?
I was going to say. Yeah, we exactly. Which one?
It was Korn and...
Orgy?
Korn, no, it was Deadzy. Wasn't it you guys came out and opened for Deadzy?
I think we did that one in Baco. Okay. I think maybe in Baco.
We did, I remember Korn. Incubus was there, too.
Yeah, Incubus, yeah. Orgy, Korn, Head, like that. Yeah, exactly. I did a lot of blow with some people there. I didn't even like blow. So when was the first...
I can tell, folks, if you have this address.
No, I'm joking.
Done.
So
I went to settle the show. I had been doing a lot of cocaine, and I couldn't fucking speak. And there I am, the tour manager / tour accountant, and they're paying me. I'm the responsible one. I'm collecting the fee for the band, and I was so gacked out I couldn't talk to the accountant who works for the concert promoter in that city to pay us. And I walked out for that. I'm like, fuck, you're out of control.
Yeah, that happens. And then so how do we go from a couple mess ups to like hitting bottom and knowing you need help?
You know, those moments like that, it just continued to escalate where what did we do? We toured the States and then we went to Australia. And by that point, it was almost I was drinking daily.
Yeah.
You know, I was drinking daily.
Were the bands starting to give you a hard time?
I never got any grief really from the bands of like, hey, you know, now that I say that, this memory pops in mind. Years before, and I was working with Electric Love Hogs, one of the band members made a comment to me, and I still carried around because it really hurt. One of the guitar players in Electric Love Hogs, Donnie, he looked at me in the hotel one day and he goes, you know what, bro, you really treat us like shit, really treat us bad. And my behavior, it was always about how I react. And that was 15, 20 years ago.
And it probably carried around because you know that's a truth that you have a challenge with.
Exactly. I mean, drinking and using, I don't put on my best face forward. I don't conduct myself in a way that I'm proud of. And it's come up in the last year and a half, too, of like when I look back at definitely my drinking and using life and a lot into my sobriety, there's a lack of integrity in how I conducted myself. And I'm like, I don't want to go continue doing that. Mm. And sometimes it's just yelling at the TV repair guy over the phone because I think that's okay.
Right.
But I'm not practicing these principles in all my affairs. I'm not treating the valet like I should treat the rock star. And that bothers me. I don't want to be that guy. So we went to Australia, which was great. Ugly Kid Joe had... multiple platinum records. They had 2 big hit songs.
Yep.
We were there. Bon Jovi was there, like playing the Sydney Opera House, like 6 sold out shows or something bananas. Mm. And it was a big deal. They were there. We were there for a month to play all these shows and do the stuff with those guys.
That's a long time for Australia.
Yeah, a long time. One of the Bon Jovi guys got arrested coming into the country. He was trying to smuggle drugs into Australia. I had to pull him aside later and go, you know, they have drugs here, right? We couldn't use while we were there the entire time because of an arrest within the first week. They were like, if anybody gets arrested, you'll never leave this country.
Right.
And so I drank and drank and drank and drank.
Because you didn't have drugs, so you drank more?
Yeah, exactly. And
did you know that that's what you were doing?
I do now.
Yeah.
I had to offset that not having the drugs and stuff. I'm really not a pot guy. I've never really enjoyed pot. And so... And that was the beginning of the end. The tour ended. I flew home. I got home. My little apartment that I kept in Hollywood had been robbed. And they took all this stuff. They kicked the door in, took a bunch of stuff, left a bunch of stuff behind. But I'd hidden a couple 8-balls.
Whoa.
They didn't touch it. I drank on this 18-hour flight the entire time. Got home, saw that, found the blow, immediately...
That's how you get through it.
Yeah, exactly.
My apartment's been ransacked. Everything's stolen. Thank God I got cocaine.
Oh, thank God they didn't find that. And so, that's when I started to use, and that was the beginning of me going into treatment. I used for about a month and a half every single day, all day. I would stay up till 4 or 5 in the morning and then sleep, and then halcyon, ecstasy to fall asleep, and then cocaine, wake up at 11, take as many...
Straight to the cocaine?
Straight to the cocaine.
That's harsh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I remember those last days.
How'd you feel during that?
Well, this is
were
what I was...
Were you miserable?
Horrible. I was... I could
Did you ever get suicidal? thoughts?
No, I don't remember that. But I was one of those guys that I couldn't walk past a mirror and look at myself in my reflection. I was creeping from the peephole to the curtains. And then my thing was, and it's glamorous, and I hope, you know, you never have to get to this place, Wes, is that I would turn on the security camera, turn on, back then I think it was that really cheap form of adult entertainment, red something splat, and then, you know, pull my pants down and gently touch myself as I'm flipping back from porn to the security camera, hoping they didn't come, or I did. And that was how I spent the last month before I made the call to...
That is glamorous.
Oh, such a good time. You know, as they say, it's a progressive disease, and we go right back to where we left off if we ever do go out again after getting sober.
Right.
Fast forward 7 years later, I'm down in Jamaica working on some other event, and I ended up going out on the last night, the very last night. I was there like 2 weeks. It's cliche, and I think most people experience when we do go out, we're not doing anything related to AA. We're not doing any kind of daily practice. We're not
doing No
program of recovery. I wasn't talking to my sponsor. I wasn't going to meetings. I wasn't around anybody sober.
Right.
I was surrounded by cocaine girls and musicians, my three, you know, Achilles heels.
With no reinforcements.
With nothing to talk about. And on the last day, we bought a baggie, and someone said, dude, your turn, and I hit it. And
you were defenseless against the first drink, or in this case, drugs.
Yeah, so.
We're going to bring in the song now. We're here on Rock to Recovery Radio talking to Scott P., tour manager to many of your favorite bands, and he's hit bottom here. Too much porn and cocaine. I mean, how many people can relate to that story? And so is that why you picked this song, November Rain? Is this kind of like your bottom song, The Dark? Because it's a sad song to me. It's very sad. Very sad.
You know, that's really not why I picked that, actually. It was two songs. I was like, how do you pick two songs?
You got an hour show, man. So what?
It hasn't. It's because my friend was back when I lived in San Diego, and I was in the height of my using, the height of my dealing, the height of the chaos. One of my buddies that I worked with the music got the gig and ended up managing Guns N' Roses.
Oh,
and,
who?
Doug Goldstein.
Doug Goldstein. Yeah. Okay.
And I went to junior college with him and knew him, and he kind of pulled me into that world. And that was my introduction to Guns. And I ended up dating a girl that worked in Doug's office who. She had gotten married, and then actually Guns played her wedding. And then
that's
exactly.
That's a good wedding.
Yeah, and I met her a year later. And, you know, over the last 15 years, those guys, you know, Camp Freddy, when I started working Camp Freddy, was the whole story in itself. It was 10 years. I worked for him for 10 years.
Yeah.
And during that time period, we did hundreds of shows with probably 1,000 different musical guests. And a lot of the Gunners did it a bunch of times. And now I have this relationship with some of them.
Yep.
Which when you're a kid growing
which
up.
Which several of them are sober. I won't say their names. But yeah.
But when you're a kid growing up in a town with one stoplight and one AM radio station, we had two TV channels. When I think about it driving down here tonight, I'm like, you know, dude, you wanted to work in music and you have toured the world by the grace of God. And, you know, and it's
and
like.
You survived.
And survived.
Unlike many of our friends.
Yeah.
So here it is. Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer, and this is November Rain by Guns N' Roses.
Plus, it's an amazing guitar solo. The best.
I guess I picked the live version. Thank you. You gotta love it, man. You gotta love some November Rain.
So good.
Life changing.
This carries it. It's amazing. It's timeless.
So here we are. We're back on Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm here with Scott P., tour manager to so many rock stars that you love, telling this story from, you know, childhood abuse to addiction. You know what we didn't get into, and we're almost out of time here. But you battled cancer and you overcame that and you're sober. So let's talk about, we just covered how you hit your bottom, the cocaine and chasing women and the sex issues, right? The porn webcam and the porn toggle thing, that just burned in my mind.
Spice Channel, that's what they used to call it.
Yeah, I remember. I never watched it, but I heard about it. So what was the key for you to get sober? And where'd you get the strength in your sobriety to stay sober?
Get sober. So we came home. I went on this bender, and I got lucky, and I got to go to rehab. And I didn't want to go. The guy told me, like, oh, come get some sun, eat some good food, stick around.
Did you go to the one in the Bahamas or something?
The one in the desert, the old Betty Ford one.
Oh, Betty Ford, yeah. Gotcha.
Which was a great experience. Looking back, it was awesome. I'm really glad I got to go to treatment. I needed that. I'd never been around sobriety. It was awesome. So, you know, I met a girl at rehab in Betty Ford, and they don't let you fraternize. And
oh, yeah, they don't want that.
Yeah. And even though there was a 12-step program, which I'm completely believer in the book and completely an advocate of, you got to work the 12 steps. That's where the work begins to uncover not why we're alcoholics. I think that is we're born as alcoholics, but why we drink sometimes. That was the beginning of it all. But, you know, when you asked me that question, I'm at a pause. But because I met a girl in treatment, I didn't know then that sex addiction was an addiction. I thought it was all about drugs and alcohol. I got to go to treatment to stop cocaine and alcohol, and then I will be fine. Yeah. No, I didn't know that you're like, no, that's the crutch. That's not the problem. The problem is you have alcoholism with
behavioral
all,
issues.
Yeah, and you have all this mental illness and behavioral issues, and no one taught you how to live right. So I met this girl, which was like, to me, was normal. Okay, you're going to meet a girl. And then I got out on New Year's Eve, 26 days. You're like, we trust you. We're going to let you out on New Year's Eve.
Sounds horrible.
Yeah.
Like a bad choice.
Yeah. A week later, I was on a plane to Hawaii with half a cocaine of blow strapped to my chest to do a drug deal.
Oh.
You know, because that's what I knew. And even though in Betty Ford they require that you get to the fifth step before you can get out, and I worked a fifth step, I didn't put the practice this principles in all my affairs.
Right.
I didn't do a daily reprieve and stuff. So those first 7 years of sobriety, when I say, hey, I have a lot of remorse what way of conducting my behavior because I wasn't living a sober lifestyle. I may not have been drinking and using, but I was lying, cheating, and stealing and acting out. I got arrested in my first year of sobriety for a drug deal, you know?
A lot of people do that.
Yeah, exactly.
They say, what happens when you get a drunk? What do you have when you get a drunken horse thief sober? You have still a horse thief.
Yeah, exactly.
So we got to change.
So being sober and not drinking is a huge benefit. But for me, I have to work the steps. Some are sicker than others. I am. I have to work the steps. I have to be daily involved in stuff. And after that slip, I didn't know then that slip was going to save my life. I slipped for one day. I had 7 years. It's in Jamaica. Used, came home, and immediately went to the program like it was going to save my life because I was afraid. I was afraid that I was not going to be okay. And I really worked the program. A year and a half later, I was diagnosed with cancer. And if I wouldn't have slipped, I feel confident that I would have never been able to go through treatment.
Right, because you came back like you had more intensity and focus on it.
I wanted to be sober. I wanted to do better. I wanted to feel better, act better. I wanted the benefits of sobriety that I saw my friends who were doing the daily sobriety stuff get. I wanted some of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what that was really the beginning. That slip saved my life of like, this is important. You know, I have to give a shout out to the guys in Camp Freddy and all these people that came to my rescue, literally came to my rescue when I had cancer. It went on for 2 years. I went over to three.
They had a benefit concert for
me. They played a benefit concert for me at the Viper.
And so for the people who don't know who Camp, because a lot of people don't, Freddy is Dave Navarro. Back then it was Matt Sorum, was it?
Dave Navarro, Matt Sorum, Chris Chaney, Billy Morrison, and Donovan Leach.
So you're talking Jane's Addiction, Guns N' Roses, Cult, Billy Morrison was
Billy Idol.
Idol
Cult, and then Chris Chaney was
Jane's Addiction.
Alanis Morissette, Jane's Addiction.
Oh, yeah.
But what made them great, though, was every song was a guest, every song was a cover.
Yeah.
And over the years, it was Joan Jett, Exhibit, Dre.
You name it.
Jason Bonham, I mean, Slash, Duff. You name it, they did.
Yeah,
it was Zach Wilde, awesome. But those guys played a benefit for me, and
So I love that message.
Yeah,
I love the message that in sobriety you still could be part of the music world with A-list celebs and have them not have it not be awkward, but have them support you in your new life. That's cool.
And they were an amazing example of sobriety, integrity, honesty, do the right thing. It's not just about, hey, we're not just not drinking and using. We're going to do the right thing today. We're going to be good humans and men today. And a really amazing example of how to live, you know? And that's what really kicked it off for me. So I got interviewed for something recently, and they go, so you're volunteering this thing. Why are you here? And I literally said, my friends F me. He goes, what do you mean by that? I got a medical thing that came up. I needed 47 treatments of one thing. I needed 47 rides. My friends came and gave me a ride 47 times at 8 o'clock in the morning. I go, I would have never done that. But I wouldn't have got up at 7:30 to go pick somebody up. My friends did it 47 times. And I like, they taught me what it's like to be of service, to give back. That's why we get sober.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It's a great story, dude.
It's a beautiful thing. And then I got really lucky, you know, really lucky.
I love it. I love hearing
about it. Do we have any minutes left?
We have 0 minutes left.
Oh,
we have negative 2 minutes. Dude, your story is amazing. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for sharing so vulnerably. We could go so into so many of these layers, but the message is there that, like, your life got better. What I like is the inference, like we were talking about a second ago. Somebody could think, they often think, I get sober, now I'm like the outcast. But here you are with these rock stars, and they're embracing you and your sobriety and your recovery, and people like that are giving you rides to help save your life. That's what we get in recovery, army of amazing humans that wants to help
us. Exactly. I went to a stag and said, I just got diagnosed with cancer. I'm going to fall apart. I don't want to fall apart. And a guy shared, it's okay to fall apart. I don't want to ask for help. No, ask for help, because that's the 12th step. If you don't ask for help, we don't get to complete the program.
I love it. I love that.
That made me be like, dude, this is what it's supposed to be like.
Yeah.
Leading example men. And I go to 4 or 5 stags a week now. Men leading example. Like, we're going to go forth and be of service. That's awesome. I never heard that as a child.
There it is right there. So if you're out there struggling, you can have experience like Scott, like me. There's a bunch of people out there that would love to help you. You're not too sick. You're not too broken. You can do this thing. Just don't give up. Ask for help. This has been Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Gear. This has been my amazing homie, Scott P. And guess what? We're out of here.
Thanks, Wes.
You're welcome.
Love you. We just want to